With me now is pianist and composer Ray Bryant, who's making a return visit to Philadelphia, his hometown, for a performance tonight at the Newsstand in Center Square. In the early 50s, Bryant got his professional start in Philadelphia working as the house pianist at the Blue Note, the club owned by Jack Fields. As he got established, he recorded with Miles Davis and Sonny Rollins, as well as recording solo and with his own trios. Ray Bryant's recent records are on the Pablo record label. Before we meet Ray Bryant and talk to him about his work, let's listen to one of his recordings on Pablo. We'll be hearing a recording of John Lewis's composition Django, and this is from a live performance at Montreux. The album is called Montreux 77, Ray Bryant.
Thank you.
Ray Bryant playing Django from his album Montrose 77 on the Pablo record label. Ray Bryant is my guest now on Fresh Air. He's in Philadelphia to perform this evening at the Newsstand in Center Square. And if you'd like any information on this performance, you can call at 564-4600. Ray Bryant, what a treat to meet you. Welcome to Fresh Air.
Thank you. Nice to be here, Terry.
Since you're from Philadelphia and got your professional start playing in Philadelphia, I thought it might be interesting to talk about what the city was like during that time. Now, when you were starting to play, it was what, in the early 1950s when you started to really work professionally?
Actually, before that, I guess. But I guess the 50s, that was when I played in places like the Blue Note. And before the Blue Note, I played at Billy Kretschmer's jam session for a couple years. I was the steady pianist there.
Who were the musicians around town who you knew at that time and who would get together and play?
Well, we used to have jam sessions at Johnny Cole's house, Johnny Cole's trumpeter, and Jimmy Oliver would come by. Philly Joe Jones was around at that time. Bill Barron, Kenny Barron's brother, was playing horn at that time. And I didn't know Bobby Timmons at that then. Bobby came up a little after I did, I think. And I also did not know McCoy Tyner. They're a couple years younger than I am, I think. Yeah. But we used to have good sessions there at Johnny's house. And as a matter of fact, they were so nice that some guys used to come over from New York City to these sessions and so forth. You know? And, of course, there were lots of places to play. I don't know what happened to them. You know, there's so many places back then, like the Zanzibar. And these places all featured jazz. The Cotton Club, the Ridge Point, and of course, you know, the Showboat and the Pep Lounge on South Street.
Clubs I've heard a lot about.
Yeah, well, they've all been gone for so many years, and these places were really something else.
How did you learn how to play? Did you have a teacher, or did you pick it up? I know your mother played.
I studied classical piano for about 10 years. My mother sent me to a piano teacher.
Did you like playing classical music, or did you always try to break out of that?
No, I liked it. I didn't try to break out of it. I started listening to jazz, and I said, hey, this is what I want to play, you know?
Were there any objections from your mother, since she played mostly gospel music, and I don't know how affiliated she was with the church or what her attitude would be towards playing in clubs?
Well, jazz is associated with playing in nightclubs and things like that, you know, which was, against her religion and like that, you know. But as years have gone by, you know, she's separated the music from the iniquities of the nightclubs and things like that, you know. But there was never any really terrible objection, you know, but she would much I preferred that I played in the church, which I did do from time to time.
Do you feel like the church influenced your music?
Of course. Sure.
Did you ever have to, when you were young, convince your mother that everything was going to be all right and she needn't worry about it?
No, I don't think she worried that much about it. You know, just that she just, like I said, just that she would have preferred me to play, you know, in a different setting than I was. You know, I mean, I was very young when I first started playing clubs. I was only like 14.
Oh, I love
the Vice
it when
Squad
musicians
is listening. It's too late now because I'm past 21 now.
I just love it when musicians who couldn't even order a beer in a club end up being the pianist there.
Oh yeah, well I can go way back to age 14. I was playing at a place called Pitts's Musical Bar. That was down on 13th and Poplar. I was playing down there with a bass player by the name of Bass Ashford, Gordon Bass Ashford, who passed away a couple of years ago. And that's where I really got my start. I was playing on it with guys like Buddy Savitt. And once in a while, they'd bring over a saxophone player from New York City by the name of Eddie Lockjaw Davis. And you know, Eddie is one of the great tenor saxophone stylists of all time, right?
How old were you when you were the house pianist at the Blue Note?
Oh, around 24. 25.
Was that like the true test of your skills for you and for the people who came in? Because I'm sure you had to be the pianist for a lot of the people who came in, including, I think, people like
Charlie
Parker.
Well, it was a test. I don't know if it was a true test. I don't know if I've gotten to the true test yet.
Uh-huh.
It was a test, you know, but I didn't think of it as being a test. I thought of it more as a great opportunity to learn.
Were there people
and to be associated with these great musicians.
Were there people who you were particularly excited about when
well,
they
I mean, who would not be excited about playing with Charlie Parker and Lester Young and Charlie Shavers and who else used to come there? Terry Gibbs, Sonny Rollins, you know. Well, this is how I came to record with people like Miles Davis and Charlie Shavers and so forth, Roy Eldridge, and, you know, and Billie Holiday used to come. Of course, Billie always brought her own accompanist, so I never really got a—I never got a chance to play for her.
I know she brought Mel Waldron to town a couple
of
times.
Mm-hmm. But it was great just being there, just being that close, and we got to be, very close friends. And so the experience at the Blue Note was one of the greatest of my life.
You recorded with Miles Davis. Now he has a reputation amongst lay people, anyways, as being extremely uncommunicative. Is he that way to work with also?
No. He likes musicians.
Is everyone else he doesn't like?
No, that's not true. That's not true. Miles has his own ways. He doesn't say much, you know. He doesn't say much. He's a man of very, very few words. And he doesn't want to waste time with somebody who said something that doesn't make any sense to him, you know, like that. And so, his attitude turned some people off, you know. But I've always gotten along with Miles, you know, and most of the guys that who work for him like him. So, you know, we all have our little ways, and I feel that a guy of Miles's immense musical genius is entitled to have a couple little ways, you know.
When did you leave Philadelphia for New York?
Well, I left Philadelphia the first time. My first trip out of the city playing with a band was around 1949. I left town with Tiny Grimes, who was still very active and playing great. As a matter of fact, he's playing at Sweet Basil in New York City, and I intend to go by and see him one night this week. And I was out with him for maybe a year, and then I came back, and that's when I stayed around, you know, until after the Blue Note thing and like that. It was during the Blue Note stint that I met Carmen McRae, and she needed an accompanist. And so I left town with her around 1956, and I stayed with her for about 2 years. Then I came back to Philadelphia, and things were pretty slow around here, you know, because all those clubs had phased out and closed and so forth. I don't know what happened. So I said, the place for me is New York. And so I packed up and moved to New York, and I've been there ever since.
Was it hard to get started when you got to the city, or did you have enough of a reputation at that point so that you were able to
When I got to New York
to
City,
work?
I was one of the busiest piano players in town, you know, because I knew almost everybody, you know, from traveling around with Carmen and from having played with him at the Blue Note and so forth. And so I had no problem at all. It was the greatest move I ever made in my life.
That's great. Because I imagine that that's also a real period of reckoning for any musician when you leave your hometown and go to what's considered to be the center of jazz in the whole world, New York.
Yeah. And
there's so many musicians there.
Oh, yeah. Yeah. Competition is great and so forth, like I said. But I had no problems. As a matter of fact, I was working two jobs. Once I was playing at the Metropole in the afternoon with guys like Coleman Hawkins and Charlie Shavers and Roy Eldridge. And at nighttime, I'd go down to the Fire Spot and play with Curtis Fuller and Benny Golson and guys like that.
Is there any,
and I was doing some recordings at that time, too.
Was there any expectations then of the type of style that a piano player should play to be versatile enough to play in different settings?
Well, no, I didn't worry about that much because I found that a C chord is a C chord wherever you play it, whether you're playing it for Coleman Hawkins or Benny Golson. And that's just the way I felt about it, and that's the way I still feel about it.
Are there pianists who you feel have had a strong influence on the style that you develop?
Well, I can name the pianists that I have listened to most and respected the most. You know, well, of course, my number one would be Art Tatum. He's the complete pianist, and then I used to listen to Teddy Wilson a lot. And then when the bebop era came in, I listened to Bud Powell and Charlie Parker. You know, Charlie Parker is not a pianist. He was a horn player, but I think his style affected almost anyone who listened to him. So, and then all the other guys were around that time too. But my main influences, I mean, I guess if there are such, would be Tatum, Wilson, Bud Powell.
I know some musicians have said that when they first heard Parker, they were nearly on the verge of giving up because what he did was so revolutionary and so complex and so different that that they knew it was going to be really hard to keep up with that. What effect did it have on you when you first started hearing Parker and bebop?
Well, it has had the same effect on me then as it has now. As a matter of fact, I was in a club in New York City last night, and Just Friends by Charlie Parker came on. That's classic, right? I mean, you just have to stand back and listen in awe and great awe and respect of this man. And the things that he played then are just as fresh and awe-inspiring now as they were the day they were recorded.
That's true, yeah. In about, I guess it was 1959, you recorded a solo piano album called Alone with the Blues.
Right.
There's so many solo piano records coming out now. I don't think there were many solo sessions like that in 1959. What was the inspiration for that recording?
Well, like, as you say, there weren't too many because nobody wanted to tackle it. Well, I was recording for Prestige at the time. I'd already done my trio set for Prestige. And my producer there, Esmond Edwards, called me up one day and says, "Hey, I want you to make another album." And I said, "Okay, how many? All right, when do we?" He said, "Not we, it's just you. So we want you to do a solo album. We think you can do it." So he convinced me that I could do it. And so one Saturday morning, was nobody in the studio, but just him. No, three of us. Esmond, my wife, and myself. And he said, "Just sit down and play whatever you feel." And had nothing prepared. He said, "Just play the blues. We know you can play the blues. Just play the blues by yourself." And that's how that came about.
Did you just one take of everything?
Just about. One take of everything, yeah.
Well, it's a great album. Let's listen to a session from it. And what we're going to hear is the opening session from Ray Bryant's solo album, recorded in 1959, Alone with the Blues. Thank you. Ray Bryant at the piano from his solo album made in 1958 called Alone with the Blues, and he called that Blues Number 3. Ray Bryant is my guest here on Fresh Air. He's in Philadelphia, which is, by the way, his hometown, to perform tonight at the Newsstand. And the sets begin, I believe, at about 8 o'clock. If you'd like to call for any more information about that, you can reach the Newsstand at 564-4600. Ray, the albums that you've been doing recently are on the Pablo record label. Before that, you did some recording for Prestige. What kind of recording session do you feel most at home with?
Well, one where they don't bother you. Just turn on the machines and let us do it. You know, play whatever we want to play. And that's the situation with Pablo. So I really enjoy recording for them because there's no pressure on you to do anything. You just do whatever you feel like doing.
How do you shape up what the concept of an album is going to be, if there is one?
Well, sometimes you don't know. Like, my latest one is, which I forgot to bring, is All Blues for Pablo. And actually, how this came about was that there was, I was supposed to have a guest, Milt Jackson. But Milt got hung up somewhere out in the Midwest and somewhere, and he just couldn't make it. So we were at the studio, so we had a trio. We had, you know, I had Sam Jones and Grady Tate. So we just started. So Norman said, "Well, just, you know, since we're here, let's just play some trio things. Anything if you like playing." So we ended up doing the old Jumbo Symphony Sid and Billy's Bounce, and then something else. And so I say, there's three things that are in the blues. You know, they're blueses. You know, so I thought, let's say this might be. You know, a nice concept for an album. And that's how that came about. We did Miles's thing, you know, with the three-quarter thing. And like that. And then sometimes an album has no real theme. You know, you just do odds and ends like that. And the simplest thing, you know, is just pick out one of the tunes and name it after one of the tunes like that, too.
How do you feel about things like liner notes? Do you like albums that tell about your life and your career?
I don't read them.
You don't read them?
I don't read liner notes. No. One thing about liner notes is that it makes it totally impossible to lie about your age.
Well, they're wrong sometimes. The liner notes sometimes have misinformation, so you can still lie. They lie too.
No, not that I want to, but I'm just saying that because they all start about the same way. He was born a certain year, right, in Philadelphia, so forth, like that. You know.
Do you read things that have been written about you? Or do you just pass over that? Do you read things that have been written about you outside of albums? Like if someone writes a review of your concert, are you going to want to try to read that?
I read the good ones.
Right. I know that it's hard to have a jazz hit the way you can have, say, a rock hit, since jazz doesn't get played much, and it's not considered to be a very commercial music right now. But you're one of the people who did have jazz hits. One of them was called Little Susie, a tune that you tell me you still play a lot. Do you think that what do you think makes for a jazz recording that's going to take off commercially like that? Is it just luck, or is it sitting down and deciding to play something commercial?
Well, you can almost tell, you know, because when you play these things in a club, you see how the people react to it. And this little thing, it was on the first place, it was a blues, and everybody likes the blues, right? And it was a sort of slightly raucous, you know, swinging with a backbeat, sort of a happy thing. And people will just say, "Hey, what was that?" You know. And we got such a response in the clubs that on my next recording session, we did it, and it did turn out to be a hit. You know, it wasn't contrived or aimed at being it. It was just a little thing that I enjoyed playing and that people enjoyed listening to, and so that's all you need.
Was there pressure on you after that to make hits?
Well, of course, record companies would like to sell records, you know, and like that. But no, there wasn't too much pressure. I got with a company a little later on, the Cadet. They used to put some pressure on us, you know, to do this and do that, like that. But still, you know, I don't think I've ever done anything that I really did not enjoy doing. You know, I don't like to try to confound the people with what I'm doing and things like that. You know, I just play the way I feel and hope that you like it.
You know, sometimes you get the feeling that a musician did an album solely with the purpose of hoping that it'll sell. It's not really the style that they play in, or, yeah. or it's not really what you think they probably yes. like. And then if that album doesn't sell, you feel really bad, like they lost on both ends. You know, it's an yeah. album they won't like, and that won't make any money.
You feel bad, but not
either.
As bad as a musician feels. But he has a choice to make, and I know quite a few guys have come to me and said, "What should I do? Should I make something to try to make something?" I said, "Well, you have to satisfy yourself, you know, and I really can't help you with that one, you know."
Do you handle the business end of your own career as well as the musical end?
Well, some of it I do. I have an agent who handles some things for me, and but most things I just handle myself, such as European tours. And if I go to Japan or someplace like that, people sort of contact me. But, you know, I've been in the business long enough to know most people associated with it, you know, and so... with the people that I know and the people that maybe one or two agents know, we manage to stay busy enough.
I'm sure a lot of young musicians talk to you about how they can get started professionally. What kind of advice do you give them?
To get started professionally?
Yeah, playing.
Just play.
Mm-hmm.
Just play.
Okay. what kind of role does music play in your life now? Do you listen to, do you go out and listen to music or play a lot of things on the stereo, or are you too busy playing yourself to sit down and listen to other people?
No, I'm not playing. I'm listening to other people. Matter of fact, I heard Mel Luce's big band last night, the Vanguard in New York. And then I went to hear Norman Simmons, a great pianist in New York City there. This week I'm going to go hear Tiny Grimes. So, and I got a stack of records at home, too.
Mm-hmm. Who are you going to be playing with tonight at the Newsstand?
Well, I have a trio tonight. Jimmy Rouser on bass, who is a former Philadelphian, and Walter Bolden, drummer from Hartford, Mass. Hartford, Connecticut, I'm sorry.
Yeah. So that's tonight. Ray Bryant's in Philadelphia to play at the Newsstand, which is located in Center Square. And if you'd like to call for any more information, the number is 564-4600, and the set should start somewhere around 8 o'clock. Ray Bryant, it's been great to speak with you here on Fresh Air today. Thanks so much for coming. I appreciate
Terry,
it.
Terry, it's my pleasure. Real nice talking to you.
Nice talking to you. I'd like to play another selection from another one of Ray Bryant's recent albums on the Pablo record label. And the album's called Here's Ray, and we're going to be hearing his recording of Girl Talk. Would you like to say a few words about the session before we hear it?
No, this is a Pablo session. I'll tell you who's on it. George Vivier is the bassist, and Grady Tate is playing drums. And Norman Granz has turned the dials, but you can't hear it.
Okay. Let's listen to Ray Bryant at the piano, his recording of Girl Talk.